CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com. Let me just switch on my camera here. We've been trying out some different cameras and different lighting and all kinds of different things. So trying to make it a little bit more exciting for you to watch us in the morning. But I don't know if you saw the news yesterday. By the way, we've got Gilly Upton and C.S. Angweni with us on the show this morning. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday, but Cyril Ramaphosa lost his iPad and the internet has gone crazy. It's hilarious, the memes that are coming.
I was trying to understand what happened because I have my afternoon time limit of when I'm allowed to be on Twitter until for my brain to remain high functioning.
Right.
And then this morning I saw something about the iPad and I didn't understand what was going on.
Well, I'm going to play you a clip of what actually happened. I think he was busy talking about how they're going to establish a new ports authority as a separate independent unit. The you know, South Africa's Ports Authority is part of the ministry. It includes energy and a whole lot of other stuff. And I think they want to pull the Ports Authority out of the rest of it. But he was there to talk about that and ended up being all about his iPad that went missing. But the most sad thing about this is, like, you kind of, if it's true that someone stole his iPad, and they've issued all kinds of statements since then, to say, no, it was the president was joking. In this clip, it doesn't look like he's joking. It looks like he's totally out of his depth, and that if he doesn't have his notes, he doesn't know what to say. It's actually a really bad reflection on Cyril, who's already looking like a bit of a lame duck. Watch the clip. It's quite long, but I'm going to play the whole thing because even if you're just listening to us on podcast, you'll be able to hear there are these unbelievably long pauses where he just doesn't know what to say. And he keeps repeating, someone has taken my iPad. I had it just now, but it's gone. Listen to this. It's so horrible to watch and horrible to listen to, but it's what happened. Take a listen.
I'm waiting for my iPad. Somebody stole my iPad.
He gets
Somebody
up.
Decided that they want to dispossess me of my iPad. So I want that. Can I have my iPad, please? So they stole it.
Oh, it's so bad. He's just standing there.
I had my iPad.
This is the guy who's got to make decisions. And he doesn't know what to do because his iPad's gone. Moves the microphone a little bit.
So where did, do you know where they took my iPad to?
No. It's he's like a an old person who's lost their medicine.
This is the problem of always handing out your gadgets to other people. It's always best that I should keep all these things with me.
Like mumbling about how you should have held on to it. It's just horrible. It's so embarrassing to hear this and see it. He's like, he's confused. He's definitely...
I had my iPad.
I had my iPad. You hear that? I had it.
I had it in my hand. It's gone.
No, it's gone. Eventually.
They've lost it, it seems.
I've lost it, it seems. I mean, eventually this dude comes up and he's like, you know, Mr. President, can you resume your seat and we'll try to find your iPad? Because he's just standing there and looking at people. It's so horrible to see. Yeah, he says, please. He says, please resume.
Should I sit down?
Should I sit down?
Okay.
It's like those people who need a minder. You know those people who need a minder when they do anything or when they go anywhere? Because they're not sure. Well, the minute they don't have their, like, speech, or they don't... I mean, can you imagine as a comedian, Gilly, you have to get up on stage sometimes. You forget stuff, or you can't carry notes.
Yes, I have got a totally different read on this
all
to
right,
you.
You go okay. first. Tell,
okay.
me, tell me what you
totally
think.
Totally different, okay? I can see what he's doing, okay? He's standing there, and he's stalling for time, because what he's watching... We don't see what he's watching, right? And what he's watching is his team scrambling to find this iPad. They're like, we better find this iPad. Now, let me tell you something. When I'm on stage, I go up and I know my material because I've rehearsed it, okay? But I don't know my jokes about the ports. okay? Cyril doesn't know his speech off by heart about the ports. Okay, if you start talking to him about, like, whatever, government expenditure that's gone missing or the COVID or whatever, I promise you he could, like, rattle off 5 minutes. But you can't expect Cyril to remember his speech about the ports. I feel like that's expecting way too much. He's got bigger fish to fry than ports.
What do you say,
And he did right. And I'll tell you what, he did right. I'll tell you why. Because he stalled until he could find his iPad so that he wouldn't start talking cuck. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, off the top of his head. He was like, I'm not doing this until things are in front of me the way they're supposed to be. And he looked very composed to me. So I have to say, I take a different stance.
See, that's where I'm torn. I'm a little torn. So on the grounds that he doesn't want to start rambling nonsense and he doesn't want to...
That's exactly what he was doing. I had my iPad, now it's gone.
That's the thing.
I lost my iPad. It's gone. I had it, but now it's gone. Like, it's just...
Right. I thought on the grounds of that, you know, just making sure that he has his iPad in his notes is a good thing. But it's then how he... dealt with it, the tone. He sounded a little Eeyore-ish. And I'm just like, ugh, grab a hold of yourself, sir. You could have just stood there, and if it went to 30 seconds, say, oh, you know what? I don't have my iPad with my notes. Let me sit down, and then let's carry on. Once I find it, we'll continue. Anyway, the presidency...
He sounds so sad, actually, he had
to make a statement around this.
All right, I'll read it to you, because I've got it in front of me. You want me to read it? And then we... I want to hear what... Because Gilly might have a point here. All right. Some found this funny, while others decried what they thought to be the brazenness of a crime that could happen to our first citizen. The presidency said, however, that the president was making a joke. Here's their quote. They go, there was no question of the iPad being missing or stolen. The president was making a light-hearted point. He was not light-hearted in that clip, while waiting for the iPad to be brought to him, which it was before he began his remarks to the media. Tyrone Seal, Chief Director of Communications in the President's Office, told Eyewitness News.
Gosh.
I mean, look, obviously he looks a little, like, discombobulated, but I honestly think he's watching what's happening in the background, and he's on TV waiting for this thing to be brought to him. So he's, like, just rambling. I do get it. I think it is funny. I mean,
but I like to think of my president as the man with the nuclear codes, even though we don't have them in this country. But, you know, the man with the desk with the big red buttons where he can push it and, you know, he can make things happen, large and in charge. But then he's also the man who's misplaced an iPad.
No,
that's not a confidence boost.
I'm not even worried about the iPad.
I'm sorry, that iPad isn't his brief. You know what I mean? It's not for him to worry about where his iPad is. That's somebody else's job.
Someone should be fired for that. But my problem is
100%.
And I don't think that you know, that everybody's going, someone has stolen my iPad, as if, you know, the crime in this country is so bad that even the president's iPad gets stolen. That's not the thing that bothers me.
Right.
The thing that bothers me is, like, he could stand up there. And Gilly, you are giving him too little credit and other people too much by saying that he couldn't, like, make a couple of jokes about people in their masks or talk about how's everybody feeling. You know, I know COVID's been really tough.
Yeah, because he was distracted because he needed his iPad.
Well,
he knew, I can't talk shit about ports, bro.
He stood there like a bewildered old man who didn't have his minder to, like, dab the corners of his mouth from the porridge. It was really, really bad. It was not a great picture. It showed this guy who's, like, totally startled, and I get a different impression from the he's like, he's where's my iPad? I had it in my
really hand. I think you're blowing it up.
It was in my hands, but now it's gone.
He doesn't have flippers for hands.
No, I was,
okay?
I was
he's now a crab.
No, I was,
yeah,
I was
a crab.
I was referring to Tyrone Seal, who's his spokesperson. I had it in my hands. Anyway, I mean, someone's got to be fired. This is embarrassing.
Do you think someone was?
You know that if
no one ever gets fired.
If you want to make news in this country, it's never about the actual news story. It's about shit like this. Remember when he put the mask on that first time on TV?
Yeah, exactly, guys. Why are you surprised? This is the man who put the mask on his face. I mean, on his eyes.
On his eyes.
Everywhere.
No.
Yeah.
Oy, oy, oy. I've got to ask you guys about this. photoshopped pictures, it's getting out of control. We played a clip the other day, and it was this woman who does her makeup, and then she looks completely different than how she looks when she starts the clip, which is fine. I mean, everybody should be making a bit of an effort. We discussed this the other day too, with the way they dress, because as Monique, the comedian, said, we all look like slobs at the moment. People are walking around in track pants, and they go to the airport looking horrible, and they go to the shops looking horrible, because we've kind of let ourselves go a little bit. Well, many of us have. But this photoshopping thing, you know, you sometimes meet people and they look nothing like their social media pictures. And I'm not on any of those dating apps, but I've got friends who've girls and guys who've dated on Tinder, for example, and then when they meet the people, they're like, whoa, you don't look anything like it. I saw this yesterday, and it got me thinking about exactly that. Here's Danny Trejo, you know, what do they call it? What do they call that? Machete was his character, Machete. And you can see he's like, you know, that's how they Photoshop people these days. They smooth everything out. Everybody looks.
I've got a different policy when it comes to dating apps, at least when I was on them.
Yeah.
My policy was not to put pictures of me looking my absolute best. I would put pictures of myself, like, looking good, but just like not like the best ever. Because my policy was like, I would like the person to be pleasantly surprised when they see me.
Yeah, I think that's a good strategy.
However, it did give me less matches.
Right. I can see how that can happen.
The marketing doesn't work. But then, whenever I would get on a date, the person would be like, I could just see they'd be like, oh.
Well, you
better than what they expected.
Better than.
You have great hair, and those eyebrows look too good to be true. So how does that work?
They are too good to be true. I bought them, but I have to say that I think that these eyebrows are the best thing going right now, and not just for me. I think for the nation.
They are, and your top, obviously, which we've already given credit to for raising everyone's spirits.
But making an effort here.
But Gilly, I mean, you didn't wake up and do the full treatment this morning. This is how you look.
No.
Yeah, this is great.
I know, this is not exactly how I look. I did a mild treatment. Very mild. This is what I can achieve in 5 minutes.
Yeah, listen, I was speaking to Mbulelo, who's been on the show a couple of times yesterday, and he was saying to me, you know, he looked at me and he's like, you have to do some work. You have to. You're going backwards.
He said it like that.
Well, kind of. I mean, we'll get him on the show and he can explain. But he's like, you need to.
Ouch.
You know, there's stuff you can do to just...
No, listen, let me tell you how it is, okay? I feel like everybody has to know their number, okay? Now, here's my thing. When I wake up in the morning, I'm like a 3, okay? I promise you, I'm a 3 when I wake up in the morning, okay? I used to wake up at a 4 about 5 years ago. It's gone down to a 3.
Okay.
With a little bit of effort, like 5 to 10 minutes, I can get myself up to like a 6. Okay, if I make a lot of effort, I can go like all the way up to like an 8, and then like if I go to a wedding, and then I get to if you add personality, forget it, boy, I'm like a 12. But you have to know where you start and where your limits are.
Yeah,
you know
right.
what I mean?
Got you. Yeah, I mean your 3 is most people's 6, I'd say. So you're lucky.
No, I'm very good at makeup, Gareth.
How did you?
5 to 10 minutes gets me 3 or 4 points up.
Yeah, wow. You see, we as guys, we can't do that stuff. They do it to us for television.
And, you know, that is our privilege, at least for now.
No, it's a good one.
But I'll tell you one thing. If it was socially acceptable for men to wear makeup, you guys would do it in a heartbeat. I mean, there is no man who has ever not done something to give themselves a leg up in this world. You know what I mean?
Of course. Why do we go for haircuts? Why do we shave? Why do we,
100%.
Yeah, for sure. Any 100%. Anything.
The second wing, men wear makeup. Trust me, it will be more than $1 billion or however big the industry is. It'll triple in size.
But there are men who are starting to wear makeup. I know that there is.
Yes. And, you know, Chanel has just released a whole range of makeup for men. It's called Chanel Boy.
Really?
Yeah.
What's his name? Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez, J-Lo's ex and the baseball player and whatnot. He's released a line of men's makeup. I don't know if I'm there yet, though. I don't want to.
I don't know. See,
it would require so much. cultural shift. It would require a huge cultural shift.
It would also mean more fighting over the bathroom, because that is why girls take a long time in the mornings. It's not true. Because it's not because
mirror. It's just the mirror.
Yeah, they're
it's
not true. They're not peeing for hours. They're like, it's the makeup. So
no.
If there's only one mirror in the bathroom, or there's only one dressing table or whatever, can you imagine the guy and the girl fighting over that every morning? It would be hell.
Mm.
You'd need to get up an extra hour earlier, which is no good.
Gosh.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Kojo before in a little while. He's someone who could probably comment on this stuff too. He's just written a book called Listen to Your Footsteps. Now, I mean, because he edited magazines, so he knows what's going on. Mm. Like, you know, Afropolitan and Destiny Man. He knows this stuff. To him, this is like probably he featured pages and pages on this in his magazines. But I can't believe this, neither can see it. There's apparently a Jackass 4 movie in the works. I didn't know that these were even still a thing.
Oh, gosh.
Did you know that Jackass was still going? I thought like some of the guys had died or how is this still going?
Do
That's
we
true.
Need?
Are they all still alive? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I thought they'd all been killed in like accidents.
A Jackass 4, when exactly, like, Johnny Knoxville is now 50 years old.
I don't know that we need a Jackass 4, but you are right. It is quite, it gets a bit harder to watch, like, middle-aged people sort of bounce off the walls.
Because they don't,
exactly.
Because they don't bounce, they just flop. They kind of, and you know that there's a broken bone or something. It's not as much fun as, you know, a 20-year-old can bounce back. They tend to, you know, my little nephew got out of hospital yesterday because he broke his arm about a month ago.
Oh, shit. They break bones very easily, actually,
so easily.
As it turns out.
And he's 7 years old, but he's fine. He had the pins taken out. He's had his cast taken out, and he's back to normal. He's in great spirits. Now, that doesn't happen when you're Johnny
That's
Knoxville
great.
At 50, you know?
No. But, you know, I think, I have to be honest, like, we have to remember – these things and where they started, like when we started watching that show, it was a long time ago. And it was before you had seen anything like that. It was outrageous. And it was so much fun to watch. It was so much fun to watch.
It was
hilarious.
But now, thanks to TikTok and, you know, these kinds of things.
We really don't need that.
You don't need a Jackass because there are people doing way dumber stuff, way more dangerous stuff. And, I mean, there's stuff I subscribe to. Like, I've got this this Instagram account that I follow where they just show – like people like smashing into things or people doing dumb stuff or falling off of ladders or, you know.
I can't watch that stuff, eh? I can't.
Really?
I cannot.
Upsets you?
Yeah, it upsets me if I even, like, not like morally. It's like I have like an instinctive reaction to it. If I even see something that looks like somebody's going to hurt themselves, I scroll very fast.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's also just not the same. So with Jackass 4, Johnny Knoxville is 50 years old. Steve O, who was one of the wildest in the franchise, is now vegan. He goes and he saves animals on these trips somewhere in mountains.
Yeah.
And then the Bam character, it's now emerged that there was a bit of a clause that he would only come back to the next movie if he got a handle on his substance abuse issues. So he has not.
Bam
and
Margera,
so now they've said no. Yeah, they're like, sorry, no, you can't come onto the, can't make it onto the new movie. And then Bam has had an issue with it and got into it with the director. The director has had to now file a restraining order against Bam. You see, now it's just middle-aged
like,
men with their
issues. How is your name still Bam at 50? Yeah. You know what I mean?
We don't want to see that. And then you're going to fall off a building and you'll be, now will be grandpa issues. We don't want to see a Jackass 4, please.
In Jackass 4, I can imagine like the main storyline is going to be around all of them losing control of their bladders, but not voluntarily.
No.
The real jackassery is their daily lives.
What's that? Sorry.
What I do respect, there is something I do respect about those three people, is that it's truly a testament to like, you want to, like, it's such a testament to sticking by your guns in terms of like something you want to do and be in life. Like you are like, I am a jackass and I'm going to do it professionally. I just love that level of commitment.
That is huge. And
to the point where you are 50 years old and you are still getting paid to literally be a jackass. I love it.
Yeah. Jeez, no. Get smashed in the balls with a hammer and stuff like that. It takes
it's like every average man's dream and they've achieved it.
No. between the Karen movie and Jackass, I just don't think we're going anywhere with the movie industry right now.
Hollywood has lost the plot, so to speak. All right, let's let's get to Kojo, because I haven't spoken to him in ages, and it's always good to have him on the show. So Kojo's got a new book out, and we remember him from his days as an editor of many of the magazines that we love. And Kojo Bafoe is with us now this morning to talk about his new book, which is called Listen to Your Footsteps. But first, let's catch up with you. How are you, Kojo? How are things going?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Good, man. You know, the first thing anyone asks anybody these days is, have you had COVID?
No, fortunately, I have not.
Oh, thank God. All right. Then we don't have to talk about that.
I'm really trying to keep it that way.
Thank God.
But I've been living a lockdown for about 5 years, so... I mean, hopefully that helps.
Yeah, listen, for people who are introverted or people who are slightly misanthropic, this has been a great time. So what have you been doing during your lockdown? You've been writing books. Tell us about what you've been up to.
My life, especially that first, 6 months, my routine in my life didn't really change. I mean, I work from home. Mm-hmm. It's getting the kids to school in the morning. During lockdown, it was getting them set up in front of whatever device it was that they were using to study. And then, just kind of looking for work, doing work when it came in, freelancing, and then, writing the book. But, I mean, my routine literally is still the same.
Well, that sounds very, to you, no gear change at all. Very, very easy. This has been a very pleasant experience. So we were talking just a little while ago about all the changes that have happened in everyone else's lives. And we were just joking because there are all these people who Photoshop themselves on social media all the time. Gilly and Sia were saying that there are suddenly male makeup products. Now, I know you're not in the magazine business anymore, but do you think that's a growing thing? I mean, this used to be your wheelhouse of kind of maintaining an eye, keeping an eye on trends, watching what was going on with, with men, with kind of what men are interested in, grooming, dating, all that kind of thing. Is this something that's at all picked up in South Africa, or are we just on a tangent?
I don't know. I've seen makeup products, and the first time I actually went to a launch, mm-hmm. it must be 2014. I went to a launch and they had makeup products for men. I'm neither here nor there about it. I personally don't think I need makeup. And if somebody else wants to wear makeup, I'll believe for them. But, these things kind of come and go.
Yeah.
And I don't think that things like this are not necessarily the things that are going to become mainstream. And the debate and the conversation around them usually just kind of belies whatever other prejudices or whatever other perspectives that we may have. I think they're more important things in the world to worry about. I mean, I saw yesterday this whole conversation about, I think Richie Nisi in a skirt, and pictures of him in a skirt. And now it's discussions around masculinity and what it means. Right. And it's just like, actually, you know, I've got bigger fish, I've got bigger things to worry about than who's deciding what they're comfortable with.
Well, I mean,
preach.
There is something to it. South Africans, we have probably some very odd ideas of what masculinity is, considering the kind of state that our society's in, and also the way that we have, an outrageous level of abuse in society. That's no doubt due to the fact that men are not living up to any kind of standard. And if we have standards, they're probably the wrong ones. But it is interesting that we live in a country, too, where people, if someone wears something, like you talk about Richie Mnisi wearing a skirt, or if someone puts on makeup and they're a guy, then that gets looked at askance. In other countries, that might not be such a big deal.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's so much, in reality, there's kind of so much that we're dealing with. Mm. And I agree, like you're saying, this idea of masculinity. And there's a clinical psychologist I talked to some years back, and he kind of shaped a lot of my thinking. And he talked about masculinities as a plural. Mm. And he talked about, to a certain extent, it's performative.
Right.
In terms of we manifest different femininities or masculinities. And the problem is that everything, all of that is tied to kind of like a particular role, a particular thing that I'm supposed to be doing. And as our society has shifted, kind of we haven't shifted with that thinking. You know, so as a man, if I'm not bringing home the bacon, you know, if I'm not bringing home the bacon, then I'm less than.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have like hectic unemployment. Mm. Even just the employment landscape like totally changed from, let's say, pre-94 till today. Right? And yeah, I mean, it's this whole thing of that I am very much a, you know, focus on what I can control,
right,
and kind of live my own life to the best of my ability. And if the way somebody else is living their life is not destructive and doesn't impede on my life, you know, like good for them. Like,
well,
and that's kind of been my approach. So because of that, I don't really engage with a lot of this stuff because I've been in the media. I watch it and I watch the conversations, but yeah.
You can observe rather than having to get involved. So listen, this brings us to your book, and I'm really interested. I'm sure Gilly and CR are too. First of all, what made you decide to write a book? And it's obviously this is drawing on your own experiences. So it's semi autobiographical. I mean, it's a bunch of essays where you are basically speaking as a son, a father, a husband, a brother, and someone who's committed to kind of sorting themselves out in the world,
yeah,
which is, I suppose, all of those are things that many of us go through and that many of us would like to put down in writing. It's a therapeutic exercise, first of all. It's cathartic. But what was the main motivation for actually getting it done? Because all of us have a book in our heads. Very few of us actually end up writing them down.
So, look, my first book, I started it in 2012 when I was actually still at Destiny Man.
Right.
And it was around fatherhood. So it was after my son was born, I started kind of scribbling stuff and reflecting on that journey. I never got around to finishing it just because of time. I mean, I was in the magazine, I was busy, I was doing, you know, kind of running around doing a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I did believe that I had a book in me, and I write every day. I mean, I continue to write every day because that's my work.
Right.
And then about a year and a half ago, I actually just started writing, you know, putting these thoughts down as little essays, little reflections, because I also journal every morning. So the first thing I do in the morning is I do morning pages. So I journal for like 3 pages, before I do anything else. And I started kind of building a little collection of these, you know, some long, some short, these essays and these reflections, and reached out to Pat McMillan, who I had a relationship with and had been kind of conversating with him before to go.
But didn't you have, you've published 2 books of poetry before this as well. So it's not as if you're new to the idea of publishing.
Yeah, but that feels weird because, I mean, like, I self-published. My father paid for the printing of the books. I put the things together. It didn't feel like real publishing.
Okay.
I had a strange form of imposter syndrome when it came to actually being an author. You know, friends would say, you've published your own books. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, like my father said, why don't you publish a book of poetry? And I'm like, I don't have money. He says, well, I'll pay for the printing. So, okay, cool. Then I'll put a book together. Like, you know, I know enough people. I know photographers. A friend of mine took a picture of the cover. I compiled the poems, edited them, went to a publisher and said, hey, listen, I've got this book. How much? And they told me, and I gave them the book and the cover, and then they gave me 500 copies later.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it counts. I mean, these days, self-publishing is...
And you have a great relationship with your dad. I mean, let's count our blessings, you know.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah, my father was my main and only parent from... Yeah. When I was what, 14 months?
Your mom.
And he believed in you, which is great.
Your mom died when you were very young, and you talk about that in the book. You talk about being raised only by your dad and kind of how you formed your identity around that. Now, it's a different story to most people who, you know, there's so many people in South Africa raised by single moms. So I think that alone is an interesting take on things, which we haven't heard more than we certainly haven't heard as much as we have from single moms or from kids who've been raised by single moms. So it would be interesting to compare the experiences. And then also living as an immigrant, because you are of German and Ghanaian extraction. You lived in Lesotho for a long time. You're South African now. And all of that must have been an interesting way to shape the character that you are, because there's no doubt that you've really made an impact in the media world. You've been one of those people whose name is well known, and you're one of those people who's produced some great stuff. And I'm just interested in where you think the major influences in your life might have come from.
As a starting point, my father. And so some of these things, I mean, the interesting thing is, if for example, I'd stayed in Lesotho, I do wonder whether I'd have been able to, or I'd have written this book this way. Because moving to South Africa and the challenges and the journey of this country has forced me to really look at certain things. When I was growing up in Lesotho, I was my father's son. My father was well known in the society. It was a small, obviously a smaller kind of society and smaller city than Johannesburg. And I was my father's son, and I was, my younger brother and sister's older brother. Or I was the guy who went to that school who was interested in these things or that, or went to these parties or hung out with that group of people. And it's in coming to South Africa where, all of a sudden, I'm having conversations around, just because I have a particular complexion, hair texture doesn't mean that I have to be colored. And what that means for identity.
This is such a prickly subject, but I love getting into it, because what certain people regard as their colored identity, especially here in South Africa, is so different to what other people think of when they think of their colored identity. I mean, in America they say mixed race. They would never use the word colored because it's actually a slur. You've got people who have a white parent and a black parent. You have people who have two colored parents. You have people who have a mixture of those different things. And they all see each other in different ways. And they see themselves in different ways. And there isn't really a straightforward colored identity, is there, Kojo?
I think there is. And I say that because within a South African context, I view colored as a, let's call it an ethnic group, in the same way that you'd have Zulu, Xhosa, Sotho, etc. Mm-hmm. The challenge becomes when you come from outside. So within a South African context, there is an ethnic group that is colored. That's kind of my view, and it took me a while to kind of get to that point to make sense of it. Outside of South Africa, in the U.S., the reason why colored is considered a slur is historical, and you have to look at it contextual. You went from colored, Negro, et cetera, and mm-hmm. there's that journey, and there's that very specific context. So you have people like me, for example, who, let's say I'm biracial. Depending on where you are in the world, I'm biracial, I'm mixed race.
Yeah.
And from a, let's call it an ethnicity or a heritage perspective, like I'm operating with Ghanaian and German. That's kind of my heritage. And that influences, you talk about influences, that also influences kind of my version of culture, how I view the world, my ritual, et cetera. The problem, the challenge becomes, and the challenge I had when I came to South Africa, is that that's tied to race as opposed to heritage or culture, right? And in South Africa, I found that even with say black, there was no understanding of nuance. because you can be black, but you know, black people are so nuanced within this country. Whereas with whites, the nuance was there, and I found that especially working in the media, right?
So that's a fascinating thing to reflect on, because you know, South Africa apparently has the second largest or the largest German population outside of Germany in the Southern Hemisphere. They've also, you know, we've kind of got stereotypical ideas of what Germans are, and some of them are funny and some of them are really quite insulting. But it's interesting, this idea of culture versus race, because South Africans haven't really grappled with that properly.
We're still.
Do you agree, Gilly? I mean, we're still dealing with race.
I can tell you that you talk about nuance. It's interesting. Like I used to think you were right, that there was no understanding of nuance in black culture. But in my experience of performing for audiences all over this country, I learned very, very quickly the hard way that there was no one seeing the nuance. I'm seen as a white woman. Even when I talk about being Jewish, that is now something, a foreign thing that I've now introduced, and there's no, there's very, very few audiences that I perform for where they go, oh, I understand that is another thing or an additional thing or a nuanced part of the thing. For the most part, I think we lack an understanding of nuance in one another's races and cultures.
And I think also the openness to recognize that we each have different experiences. And therefore, there's no experience that's more valid than the next. And for us to find our way through this is to open ourselves up more to that. I mean, I really believe one of the biggest causes of ills in this world overall, it is a lack of empathy. And I do write about it in the book. Like I try to teach. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how you go about doing that. But it's essentially, you know, empathy for me means kind of recognizing the similarities, while recognizing the differences, but also just understanding that the next person is going through their experience, and taking the time to really. Well, try and understand what that experience is. And even where you don't understand, just recognizing that, like I said, as long as it's not destructive, as long as it doesn't impact on society in a particular way, like I'm happy to let them go through that. But it's this element of understanding and taking the time to try and understand.
Well, again, we have limited resources in that respect. You can't take time to understand everybody. Otherwise, you're going to be so busy doing that all day, you're going to get nothing else done. And we were talking about earlier how, you know, it's impossible these days. Someone gave me a useful definition a while ago, which I quite like. Empathy is putting yourself in someone else's shoes, which is difficult for all of us to do because we don't know what path they've walked, right? So empathy is a much harder, much more difficult mountain to climb if you truly wish to be empathetic. I almost prefer the definition for compassion, where even though you don't necessarily understand someone's life and you haven't been there every step of the way with them, you can still make an effort to take them seriously and to appreciate their experience and to sympathize in some way with what difficulties they've been through. And I think compassion and empathy are quite different things. Someone explained that to me once, and I'm not even sure if I've explained it properly enough here. But
Gareth, it's interesting. Like, I think we talk about words like compassion and empathy where we live in a society where, you know, you're a person who deals with the public, but if you're dealing one-on-one with people, which is what we're doing most of the time, we don't even get to compassion and empathy because most of us can't even listen. That thing is so critical. Like, it's such a critical step before anything else happens. You know, oh, somebody is telling me about their experience. Let me listen and not have a knee-jerk, you know, opposite reaction to whatever's coming at me. And for me, that's changed so many things because I know myself how that compassion and the empathy has only come after I've shut my mouth.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And I guess it's also the thing of not having to have an opinion about everything. And sometimes, like you're saying, totally. sometimes actually just kind of listening and taking it in. And it's, you know, it is what it is. Like I acknowledge you. I've heard you. I don't need to now counteract you. I don't need to have a debate with you about it. It's just like, okay, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting perspective. Thank you.
Or even,
I don't do it well. But
yeah, me either. It's hard for a lot of us.
But even worse are those people who they listen to you, but then they try to solve your problems for you. Like it's this patronizing idea that, oh, I know how to get out of the tussle you're in. I've got some information that, you know, you immediately assume that you know more than that person and you're going to solve their problems. That's the worst kind of.
But you know what? I've been guilty of that because I'm a person who, you know, that is my knee jerk. And I've had to teach myself not to do that. So, Kojo, you talk about like, oh, how do we teach empathy? It's like, oh, firstly, what is your intention? And it took me a long time to understand, wait, what do I want out of these interactions that I'm having? Mm. Oh, maybe I do want more information. I want to learn something. In order to listen, I'm going to have to change my thing, my knee-jerk thing, which is what you describe, of trying to trying to give my opinion on a subject or trying to solve a problem that's in front of me, you know?
I'm just like you're trying to navigate, like, marriage, right?
Yeah. Well, this is you talk about marriage in the book.
Yeah, I mean, being married is something where, you know, the other person is telling you something. And I'm also instinctively like a problem solver. You know, so it's like this person at work is doing this. And it's like, well, actually, what you should be doing is this. And actually, and the person just wanted you to listen. They just wanted to be able to fit. Right. And just kind of get stuff out of their head and off their chest. And there you are now jumping in and going, yeah, well, what you should do is like, you know, to hell with them and you must do this and you must call your boss and you must go to HR.
Totally.
Like, actually, I didn't want any of that. I just wanted you to listen.
You also write in the book about substance abuse, which is something I didn't know that you'd been through these tussles. Tell us a little bit about that, because that must have been difficult to write, you know, especially because most people are ashamed of these things, or they haven't yet dealt with them in a significant way, or perhaps they're worried about what people will think of them or how it could impact on their career. How did that come about?
I mean, I guess I'd shared the story before, just never at this level. And I kind of, to a certain extent, I've built like a career of just telling the stuff that I've gone through. I did it in smaller ways, like it was an editor's note or it was a blog post or that sort of stuff. I mean, I used to do some kind of drug education, going around to schools and kind of talking about it. And it was kind of me coming to Joburg and getting a little caught up in, let's call it the rave scene in those days. I mean, like the late 90s. But it was more around in my inadequacies my adequacies as a human being. And that, you know, before I even moved to Joburg and had, you know, issues with certain substances, I had problems with alcohol. Growing up in a small town where literally that's what you do. You drink. That's the first thing that you do on a Saturday. You have your first drink around lunchtime, and you know, you're just popping a can of this, and then by the time it gets darker, you're drinking, you know, other things. So it was a journey, and fortunately for me, it was primarily within a year. And I had people around me that kind of opened me up or at least gave me options and exposed me to the options. And part of that journey of getting off it was starting to do that work on myself, like, and starting to understand myself and understand my triggers and that sort of stuff. And it's been long enough that, I don't know if in South Africa we have a statute of limitations. I mean, we watch so many American movies, we understand.
Yeah.
We understand their laws better than ours.
Right.
But I figured, you know, like 20 years.
That's
20 years is a good. It's a good enough period to leave between it. Nobody official will come chasing after me.
No, that's expired. You don't have to worry. But I think people's attitudes to drugs have changed so much. You said something really interesting at the beginning of this explanation that you've just given for why you included it in the book. You said you were dealing with some stuff. And I think, you know, it refers back to that experiment they've done with the mice where they put them in a cage and they give the mouse on its own, they give it cocaine in the water, and it keeps coming back, and it drinks only because they're two little water things, and the one is just plain water, and the other one's got cocaine. And the mouse that's on its own has to have the cocaine water. And the mouse that's got company and that has, you know, things to play on and things to do in its cage, it drinks the normal water. They never choose the cocaine water. So I think that that's a really interesting explanation of why so many people get into it. And it's not because they just didn't have anything else to do, or because they were bored, or because there was peer pressure. It's usually because there's something that they don't have, or that they're striving for, or that they feel left out of. There's some issue that's holding them back. And the drugs kind of help them to assuage any kind of feelings of insecurity. And that's where it starts, certainly.
I mean, absolutely. I think that's where it starts. I mean, everybody goes to it, but different people get to it in different ways. I mean, mine was literally just a Saturday afternoon. I'd been drinking and had a joint, and I was having a disagreement with a young lady whose opinion mattered. And I wasn't getting high. And I was with a friend of mine, and I was like, listen, this is irritating now. I need something that'll just, help me forget about all this stuff and, numb me a little bit, and then we can go partying after this.
Right.
And he gave me a white pill and said, he gave me half of it and said, chew on it.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, it tastes like crap, but I'll do that. And then, two, 3 hours later, I'm looking at the lights and going, oh my God, look at those lights. and that's kind of, and then it became kind of like part of my lifestyle.
Mm.
I mean, I used to park outside. I stayed with my aunt / my mom in Craighall. So I used to drive past Hyde Park, and in those days Hyde Park had these purple lights on top.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us are old enough to remember, but Hyde Park was purple after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd actually park on the side of the road after having had a couple of ecstasy pills and maybe a couple of lines of cocaine, and I'd park on the side of the road at 4 o'clock in the morning and just gaze at Hyde Park.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, Kojo, you think that's bad? You're talking about the early rave scene in Joburg. Yeah. I developed a strong affinity for bomber jackets. It was also a lifestyle.
Well, so my bomber jacket, but I had no problem with bomber jackets because my bomber jacket was actually probably a decade earlier.
Yeah.
I was in Germany and I had a Public Enemy bomber jacket.
Ooh. Wow.
And that was my pride and joy.
Yeah,
and
you win.
No wonder you got into the rave scene. You had to wear that thing somewhere.
Yeah. No, you win.
Not your fault.
Well, the book is it's out now. It is available. You can get it online, right? So that's the best place to buy it. And it's called Listen to Your Footsteps by Kojo Bafoye. There's the cover. That's a good picture of you. Who took that?
Victor Dlamini.
Very nice.
Good friend of mine, and he takes amazing pictures.
All right, so Listen to Your Footsteps is the book, and Kojo is doing what he does so well. He's also been on Kaya FM, for those people who don't know, Black Magazine, Destiny Man, Afropolitan, so many things to talk about, and we've always got time to talk to you. Thanks, Kojo. Nice to see you, man.
Thanks, you guys.
Congrats on the book.
Yeah, congrats all right, on the book. You. Very good. Cheers, Kojo. There he is. Yeah.
There's cocaine water. Tell us more.
No, so the rats, they did this experiment with the rats. Yeah, I mean, it really...
I'm talking about a marketable product here. I don't want to talk about rodents anymore, okay?
Okay.
We have vodka water, okay? We've got energy, vitamin water. Cocaine water, boy.
It's only going to be a matter of time before this stuff starts to make its way into the market. You know, they've already legalized certain things, and there are a couple of ones that still get frowned upon, but you know what's happening in America at the moment with mushrooms, right? It's like psilocybin. In certain places now, that is becoming what weed was, where you can actually buy
it. Like mainstream, yeah.
You can buy it for medicinal purposes. So people who've suffered from...
The mushroom thing is huge.
Huge. People who suffered from PTSD... can now go and get a prescription for mushrooms in states like Oregon and I think California, certain parts of California, maybe even Florida. And obviously people will say they have, PTSD, so they can get hold of some magic mushrooms. But apparently in clinical trials, they're seeing enormous improvements in people's ability to deal with past stressful and ugly situations. This is now becoming the way to treat this.
I know someone who's become obsessed with growing mushrooms, and I have to tell you, like, the one thing I don't want to hear is about, you know, like, people who get into any kind of drug think it's very interesting. The procurement of said drug tends to start becoming incredibly fascinating, and I tell you, that is one thing. Like, by all means,
it's a slippery slope.
It's a free country, but, or maybe it's not such a free country, but I don't want to hear about your mushroom farm in your balcony. I don't care.
Wouldn't you be?
You know what I mean?
Wouldn't you be extra nervous though to take something from someone who's grown it themselves? I mean, I always remember as a kid.
You mean as opposed to getting something from an international syndicate?
Drug syndicate. Yeah, sure. But,
yeah.
But I'm kind of thinking that when we were kids, we were told, you know, certain mushrooms are deadly poisonous, toadstools, and you had these pictures of which ones were dangerous and which ones weren't. But I always think back to when, you know, those first apes must have eaten these and how many of them died, our ancestors, when they first, like, picked something and ate it and thought, that's
Do you know how many apes are choosing the wrong mushrooms as we speak? I mean...
yeah, a whole lot of
now
them
that's
end up,
another pandemic.
A whole lot of them end up in psychiatric institutions, too. But it is...
Some of my friends, let me tell you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to know either how you grow it, because, I mean, growing mushrooms is apparently very complicated. I've only driven past mushroom farms and they stink. They use a lot of manure and stuff there. So I'm not sure that I want
to. I didn't think about that.
I'm not sure I want to know too much.
The only mushroom I'm really interested in is a truffle, to be honest with you.
Now, that's a big, big money business, hey? If you can farm truffles, because apparently they're extremely difficult to farm, very, very expensive to buy, obviously.
Yes.
And you need.
If you have any of those lying around, I'm interested.
You need pigs and dogs who are trained especially to sniff them out and then dig them up.
Yes, sniff them out. It's crazy. Oh.
I heard it's a thing to go truffle hunting. And by thing, I mean thing that rich people do. So, of course, that's why I'm aspiring to do it. Yeah. Just want to say, I just came back from Italy. Oh, yes. Just spend my time truffle hunting.
I can imagine.
To be honest, I don't really want to hunt any of my own food, but I don't mind if somebody else does it.
Oh.
So is it the – obviously, you like the taste of the truffles in food, right?
Yeah, I do. Oh, I love it.
I can't say that I've ever gone, ooh, that's amazing. I need more truffles in my life. But maybe I've just eaten the wrong stuff.
I think it's very particular, I guess. I guess it's just particular. You either like it or you don't, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Tracy says pigs are the best truffle hunters. It's true. It is pigs.
Yeah, that's right. And then they mostly grow in France, I think. France, Belgium, those sort of – that's where they grow the best truffles, apparently. I'm not even sure. But apparently – so Ruth says the green side is an incredible store. I suppose that's what to buy – mushrooms or weed, or I don't know. I don't think we could buy mushrooms. Eleutheria is talking about microdosing, which is such a big thing. You can blame Silicon Valley for that, by the way. And then,
well, as long as it's going to make Gilly money so that she can manufacture cocaine water, then I'm all
Gilly,
for it.
Do the cocaine water. I mean, you could be a mega.
Yeah. I think you're onto something. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Tracy says just on the.
You know, when you want to take a little edge off your cocaine.
Just put it in some water, just dilute it. Tracy says, while we were talking to Kojo, not commenting or sharing your opinion is a skill. Sometimes it's not needed. Just let it be. And Gen X agreeing.
It is a skill.
Yeah, never
miss. She's so right. It is a skill.
Right. Never miss an opportunity to shut up and listen. See, that's what you were saying.
Well, not to make her... not to make us completely innocent, but we're living in times where, you know, there are comment sections and you go onto Facebook and Facebook is asking you what's on your mind and people are now just conditioned to go on and on
their
and
opinion.
On.
But I do think it is also certain personality types, you know, and I that's why I like to, when it comes to this stuff, I like to just talk about myself in the sense of like, whenever I think, people are that I think first, am I guilty of that, you know? And I am.
That takes a lot of interest.
Well, at least you have self-awareness. A lot of people don't.
No, they always say, remove the splinter from your eye before you take the huge bulk of wood out of someone else's. But that's something that also a lot of people are not aware of. Comedians are really good at that because they're good at, they learn first to make fun of themselves, to put the audience at ease.
Well, it's not even the audience at ease. Yeah, well, it is to an extent, but self-awareness is such an important part of being a comic, because even if you don't address it, you have to be ahead of what the audience is thinking when they see you. They can't think something about you that you don't see. And in fact, when Koja was talking, and one of the things that I was saying is that, you know, it took me a long time to realize that even if I say on stage that I'm a Jewish person, in a South African context, what people see is white women. And I have to know that. I have to know that even though my reality is not singularly that, it is part of it, but it's not the whole thing. Even though for me that's not my existence, I have to know and understand well that when I get on a stage, that's what people read. And it took me a long time to just make that simple, to have that simple understanding of what people see is not what I experience.
No, and also what other people think of you is actually none of your business. I always say that to people too. You don't know what they think of you, and you can't climb into their heads. They might have all kinds of.
It's true in the world, but on stage you do have to kind of be a medium for like what people think of you, and then it's not about. I guess it is about caring. You do have to know what people think of you, and then you have to know what you want to do with that.
Yeah, you want to make a good show of it. But what I'm basically saying.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is why I've always given you guys who get on stage and make people laugh, I've given you by far the most credit in any of the performing arts, because what you do is essentially get up there and you say to people, like, I'm going to make you laugh, motherfuckers. And they're like, Ooh, I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not sure that you can. You know, it's like it's almost you setting yourself up to fail from the get-go. Most people come in with, you know, I hope they really like me. You have to have such confidence, and you have to have such an ability to turn on a dime if you sense something different in that audience. You do. You're a canary in the coal mine for any kind of audience. You guys are the best at this.
Yeah, that's something you learn. You have to learn. That's what the time on stage is about.
Well, it's probably one of those skills, among others, that you have that make people love you so much. And it's always good to have you on the show, and we love having you. So thank you, Gilly. Good to see you
again.
Thanks
for having me. I love being here.
Awesome.
You guys are great.
Yeah.
And have an excellent week. And everybody keep warm and stay away from COVID's third wave.
And stay away from cocaine water.
And stay away
until we've trademarked it.
Stay away from the cocaine water. That's Gilly's patent. She's patent pending on that one. All right. Have a happy day, everybody. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. bright and early. Be good. And if you're not, take photos. CliffCentral.com